This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's hard to overstate just how much the news consumption habits of Americans have changed in just two decades. For example, half of us today get our news on Facebook. We continue to shun print and paper, with daily circulation continuing its long slide, and we prefer reading news on our mobile devices way more than on our desktop computers, while the time we spend focused on those articles is going down. Today in The Exchange is a lot new in news, and we examine the trends. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Meg Heckman. She's a lecturer teaching journalism in the English department at UNH. She teaches a course in entrepreneurial journalism and is a former print journalist herself. And Meg, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us from D.C., Amy Mitchell, director of journalism research at the Pew Research Center and one of the authors of Pew's brand new State of the News Media Report. And Amy Mitchell, welcome. Thank you for taking time out.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, Amy, how dramatic are these changes in the way that we grab our news here in this country?
Extremely dramatic, especially if you think about the short period of time that this has evolved within. We have 81% of Americans now that are getting news online. That's compared to 12% 20 years ago. More than half, 62%, are getting news from social media alone. And when you think about young people, that's particularly where this change is really not change for them. It's just their natural way of getting news and information. 84% of 18 to 29-year-olds say that they get news from social media. So this is a very dramatic period of change. We've gotten to a point where digital is not niche. It's not new and different. It's mainstream. It's the way most Americans are getting at least some portion of their news. And along with that digital evolution, we've had mobile, which again has risen very, very quickly in terms of a mode and a method, with 72%, almost three quarters of U.S. adults getting news on their mobile device. And one of the survey questions we asked recently asked people who got news both on mobile and on desktops, what do you prefer? And we're at a point now where more people actually prefer to get their news on a mobile phone as opposed to on a desktop.
And what's the significance of that, Amy?
Well, there are a number of different things. One, it's sort of the structure and the format, but also in the dipping in and out over the course of a day. If you think about our devices that we have always at the ready, you know, it's hard to go an hour without looking at it. The degree to which people are getting news throughout the course of the day as opposed to at these very set times is has a large impact in the way people are being informed. We also find that in these digital spaces, people are more likely to bump into news, to come across it incidentally if they're not looking for it. And these are both areas that we're continuing to study in terms of what does this mean for the knowledge that people are gaining about the current, you know, issues and events of the your local area or of the world around you. But we do find that in some cases, people that aren't following news closely and may not, you know, have otherwise learned about something, either because they don't turn to a newspaper or they don't, you know, tune in to network or local television, are hearing at least about major events. So there's some kind of exposure in a way that it may not have occurred in earlier era. At the same time, I will just caveat all this by saying the platform and format that touches the greatest portion of Americans remains television. We still have a lot of Americans that are tied to that box that's in their living room or their kitchen as a way of getting their news.
So dipping in and out, instead of sitting down with that newspaper in the morning, you know, that's the classic picture, Amy. People are sort of, you know, eating a little bit of news here and there all day long, snacking, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, and print really as a form has lost its appeal. Certainly people are getting news from newspapers digitally, but we're at a point where only 2 in 10 U.S. adults are getting, say they often turn to a print newspaper. And when we asked about election news, it was far down the list in terms of being the most helpful way that people are learning about the election. So, it's not gone. And we have people that tend to have a lot of different touch points. You know, they listen to radio news, they go online, they watch some TV. So there are a lot of different touch points, but the momentum is certainly within this digital space. And there are a lot of implications for what it means to dip in and out of news. One is exposure. There's also this question of are people getting snippets of stories that may or may not always have all of the information or accurate information.
Not the full story.
At the time, right. And are they left to try to put those pieces together themselves?
Well, Meg, what's this really about? You know, changes in the way we consume news, the vehicle by which we consume news, or changes in the actual content of that news itself?
You know, I think it's both. Everything that Amy was just describing now and that I read in the report last night really tracks with my own consumption of news and what I see in my students' consumption of news. And I was actually working on syllabi for the semester yesterday. And one of the things that I'm adding is a 15-minute talk from me on the first day of class about how to set up your phone to be able to access quality news, how to set up alerts, what are some good mobile-y intelligent news organizations that students should be tapping into. So they start to think about being critical and active consumers of all the information that's coming to them on their phone. So it's been a really interesting experience to watch and learn from their consumption of news, because it's so different from how it was when I got started in journalism just 15 years ago. I remember when I was taking journalism classes, we were required to read the news, as my students are now, but we subscribed to the print Boston Globe. They got delivered in giant stacks. Just 15 years ago. The print Boston Globe, because it was still the easiest way to get a full news package. And we'd have to read it and comment on it and take pop quizzes. And those papers would get delivered outside our classroom building every day. And that's how we read the news. And now our students pay for a digital subscription to the Globe, and they read the news that way online and critique it. But I also want to add on that layer of mobile information too, so they're smart about that.
Now, I'm picturing you opening up that, you know, big gray print and paper Boston Globe, Meg, and you said something, full content of the Boston Globe. If you're reading the Boston Globe online, do you tend to do more dipping in and out, as Amy said, versus reading the whole story in front of you and your eyeballs going to another story next to it and going, ooh, that's an interesting story too?
Yeah, it's not as linear an approach to reading the news.
Well, it's comprehensive.
I find myself, that idea of dipping in and out, there's a little more serendipity, which can be great, but it also makes it too easy even for me to not finish a full story. So sometimes you don't get the context. Sometimes you don't get all of the nuances that the editors and journalists may be meant to convey.
So how has the consumption habits of Americans, again, as you said, consuming news on their devices primarily or getting it on social media, how does that change the content?
Well, I think that it depends.
It depends on who's delivering it, right?
Who's delivering it and who's sharing it and where you're getting your information. So I think it's a lot easier for us as news consumers to experience confirmation bias, to kind of get ourselves in an echo chamber where we only hear and see stories that we agree with or hear from people who we agree with. Because certainly I follow a lot of friends and family members on Facebook, and we have similar backgrounds. So of course we're going to be interested in similar things. So we run the risk of not hearing all sides of a debate. And that can be problematic in a lot of different ways.
And Amy, that's what Facebook got into trouble for, right? People said the way that it was structured was creating biased universes for its users. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, social media in particular is an area where there's certainly opportunity for that to be created. And one of the things that's tricky in figuring out exactly what's happening is it's different for each individual, because what any one person sees depends on their own habits, it depends on their interests, it depends on who they have in their network, and it depends on how that algorithm responds to what they do, responds to their behavior. So we're certainly seeing We've asked a number of different kinds of questions and done research in this space, and what we're seeing is that most people are exposed to views that are not their own. But, you know, all in all, there are just too many ways that people are, you know, hearing about things and getting some exposure that people do tend to see things that are not in line with their own view. But there is a greater tendency, particularly among those, and this is, you know, when we ask about sort of news about government and politics, for those that are the most ideologically aligned to have a network that is most reinforcing of their own views. So we certainly do see that kind of tendency. And it takes effort, you know, on the part of individuals to work to be exposed to different, you know, to join, to follow somebody that they know reports something that isn't, you know, absolutely in line with their own way of thinking.
And what does it mean, by the way, Amy, to say that, as you did early on, that half of all Americans get their news on Facebook? I mean, does that mean they're getting it from reasonable, reliable sources? You know, what does that mean exactly?
Well, again, it varies by the individual. You know, we find people on Twitter users are more likely to actually follow news organizations than folks on Facebook, where you only have, you know, roughly 3 in 10 that are following news organizations directly. But in many cases, people are clicking on links that go to a news story. And whether that news story is, you know, from a news outlet that is, you know, traditional in the way that we tend to think of news outlets, or it's a blog, or it's, you know, something different, that we're, again, continuing to do research on. So it varies by individual. We also find that people are they think about that personal connection. So they think about who is it that passed on that news to me when they're, you know, choosing whether to read it or how to respond to it. And so there's a lot that's up to the individual to decide in terms of how they act on that particular piece of news. We did do a study looking specifically at long-form versus short-form reading on cell phones, on mobile phones, because one of the questions I've been asked a lot when I'm out doing talks and conversing with people is, you know, what will people read on their phones? I mean, if more and more people are turning to their phones, are we down to the 5-line snippet? Is that, you know, where we're going to end up? And what we found was pretty interesting. All the different ways that we sliced the data, we did find that people indeed, excuse me, spent more time with long-form content than they did with short-form, about twice the time. Not huge amounts of time, but what it suggests to us is that there's not an automatic cutoff of what people are willing to stick with on their phones. It doesn't mean everybody can go do long form all the time and they're going to, you know, have completion rates at, you know, at 70%. But there is an opportunity, and people are willing to go longer on their phone if that piece itself is longer.
Do you want to jump into
I do, Meg? Yeah. That's I was so thrilled as a lover of long-form journalism to see that study come out, because it gives me a good argument point. But it's also really indicative of the importance of publisher choices in the digital ecosystem. Too often we hear that digital platforms are dumbing down journalism and dumbing down storytelling. And it's because the audience doesn't want meaningful journalism. And that's just not true. Publishers need to make decisions to offer and find ways to pay for meaningful journalism on digital channels. And I think that Amy's research about long-form journalism really hints that there's an audience for it.
Well, joining us now on the phone is somebody who is in the thick of exactly what you're talking about, Meg. Nancy West is with us on the line. She's founder of the New Hampshire Center for Public Interest Journalism and executive editor of InDepthNH.org. And Nancy West, welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Now, just remind us, Nancy, what your start in journalism was.
Oh, I started in journalism about 30 years ago at the Littleton Courier, and I worked at the union leader for 28 years as a reporter and editor.
Wow.
And then I actually taught at the New England Center for Investigative Reporting, and it was my first introduction to nonprofit news. I met with Ann Galloway over at the Vermont Digger and realized we just need that here in New Hampshire. So I started InDepthNH.org.
So it's a nonprofit newspaper online? Is that the best way to describe it, Nancy?
Yes, yes. We're a news outlet online, and we really focus more on in-depth journalism. We don't compete with other newspapers. We offer all of our stories for free to any news outlet in Hampshire that wants to use them. And a lot of, you know, a lot of our stories are being picked up by many news outlets in the state. We're trying to augment the terrific journalism that's already going on in New Hampshire, and it's working.
So in an era, Nancy, where, you know, stalwart newspapers like the Concord Monitor, the Union Leader, the Telegraph of Nashua, and so forth, have shrinking newsrooms, can't devote the reporters to some of these investigative pieces, you guys are trying to fill in that gap.
Yes, and it's working. When some of the other newspapers pick up on the stories, we pull back and start working on other important issues.
So if you are giving away this in-depth content for free, how do you pay your bills, Nancy?
Well, we're really up against the wall trying to raise money, like many nonprofits. And I think like for-profits trying to get the money to pay staff. What we do is we have we work at getting grants. We work at getting corporate donations, corporate underwriting. Northeast Delta Dental was our first signature. They're our first business that has signed on for advertising. And it's a slow growth, but that's really something we're focusing on now. This is our first year anniversary coming up. So this week we're doing a lot of fundraising, a lot of corporate, you know, knocking on doors. And we're telling a lot of stories online about who we are, what we hope to accomplish, and what we've done so far. We've broken a lot of very important stories this year already.
Nancy, one last question for you. As you know, the importance of video is growing in all forms of journalism, even for radio and print and so forth. People who never dipped their toes into television and wouldn't dream of it are now feeling pressure, feeling the need to embed video in some of their content. Are you guys doing that, or are you just too small?
Yes, we are. Recently, I was working on a story about Eric Largy in Nashua, and it was terrific to just get some video of the person who's on trial, who's going to be on trial, getting their stories in their own voices. We have Roger Wood, who does, God, I think he's done 70 podcasts for us. And we have other terrific writers like John Harrigan, who's also experimenting with video for us.
And those are some long names in New Hampshire journalism. So there you have it.
I was writing up a little brief about us today, and we have over two centuries of experience.
Well, Nancy, it's great to talk to you, and good luck.
Oh, great to talk with you. Thank you.
That's Nancy West, founder of the New Hampshire Center for Public Interest Journalism, editor of InDepthNH.org. Coming up, how one Vermont investigative news website manages to dig up digital stories in the Green Mountain State. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, The Exchange, where Americans get their news these days and where they don't. Where do you tend to find news? Is it on radio, TV, scrolling through a news feed on your phone, an old-fashioned print and paper newspaper? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Meg Heckman, lecturer teaching journalism in the English department at UNH, and a former print journalist herself. Also with us, Amy Mitchell, director of journalism research at the Pew Research Center and author of Pew's latest State of the News Media Report. 1-800-892-6477, again, is the number for you to join us. And Meg Heckman, I just wanted to ask you real quick, after we talked to Nancy West from InDepthNH.org, a nonprofit news organization doing in-depth stories on sort of the big issues here in the Granite State, and then giving those stories to free for shrinking state newspapers that maybe can't afford the staff to do that type of reporting. What do you make of that financial model?
I think that finding a sustainable business model is probably the single biggest question facing journalists and the news industry right now. I mean, certainly the Pew Report and everything we've seen and heard in the industry over the last 10 or 15 years really points to a decimation of the business model that long supported legacy news organizations. Print and broadcast revenues are down. Well, print is definitely down. I think Amy could probably tell us better about broadcast revenues. And we're not seeing the digital we're not seeing the digital ads really replace that money. And at the same time, we have tools that are allowing people like Nancy with years of investigative journalism experience to find a way to get the stories that are maybe not being told or not being told fully because of resource challenges in legacy newsrooms. She's able to get those stories out there. And the question is not the quality of the journalism or really even the audience for the journalism. The question is, where is the money going to come from to pay for the journalism? And I think we're seeing a variety of models come out. We're seeing the nonprofit model that's not dissimilar to public radio. We're seeing some for-profit models. And one of the things that I'll be interested in seeing in the future is, are news organizations creating themselves as so-called benefit corporations? That's a new type of legislation or a new type of corporation where companies can kind of form themselves in a way that serves both profits and the greater good. And I haven't seen a whole lot of that, and I'll be interested to see if that's something that is happening in the future.
Well, you kind of feel some sympathy for traditional newspapers anyway, because not only do they have to change the whole way that they deliver their content, but also the way that the money comes in. It's two giant shifts at the same time.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. And I think bottom line, any news organization is going to have more limited resources than 15 or 20 years ago. And again, it goes back to publishers making good choices, choices to actually practice journalism. And when resources are available, use them to hire journalists and let those journalists actually do journalism. There is an audience for it. There is a hunger for it. And it needs to be packaged in a way that gets to the audiences that need it the most. And that can be really challenging here in more rural areas. It's easier to get a critical mass of subscribers or members or venture capitalists if you're working in a more urban area and a bigger market. But when you start getting north of Boston or into more socioeconomically depressed regions elsewhere in the country, it can get really challenging to find the money necessary to really support the news product. And those are areas that desperately need journalism.
Well, and Amy, something I have yet to figure out is why the revenue that newspapers used to get from classified advertising and just regular old, you know, Joe's Auto Body Shop who would advertise in the newspaper, why that doesn't just translate over to digital.
Well, advertising works in an entirely different way in the digital space, and the prices are much lower overall. There's money being made in digital. It's just not going to news organizations. Much of it is through ad networks, so the kind of sales, ad sales, that your local newspaper would do going sort of individual to individual, you know, to purchase specific ads in their paper. Now those are done through these ad networks, and an organization can buy hundreds, place hundreds of ads through one "quote unquote buy," you know, in different local entities when they give the ad network individual the demographic, sort of the kind of person that they want to be able to hit. So the dynamics of it and just the function are very different. You know, to a certain extent, I mean, newspapers have been hit hardest and they were hit first, largely because the text is what started in the digital space, and so people who were reading newspapers migrated there first. And to a certain extent, the newspaper industry was slow to respond to that change. At the time that audiences were moving, a lot of the newspapers in the country were still seeing 30% profit margins. So there wasn't this panic to figure out how to have real estate online. And that they had lost that. You know, that got lost to Realtor.com and to these others. Same with classified advertising as Craigslist was started. We now have newspaper ad revenue that is a third of what it was roughly a decade ago.
Wow, a third. That's a big chunk.
A third. I mean, it's huge. And the problem is that, and it's continuing to fall, you know, at large percentages year in and year out. And the problem is that most of that is still coming from print. So, you know, you're at a point where print's accounting for about 80% of subscription revenue, and it's accounting for about 75% of ad revenue. So even as most everything else is migrating, the focus is on the web, the focus is on the digital product, newspapers can't walk away from that print product because that's still giving them the bulk of their revenue, even though that revenue is much, much smaller than it was in the past.
Wow. And didn't you tell us right at the beginning of the show, Amy, that only 20% of Americans roughly still read that print and paper newspaper?
Yeah. I mean, what we had found, you know, maybe 3-4 years ago was that there was still this kind of core audience that was really dedicated to print. And I would say there are places in the country where the print paper is still important to those local readers. You know, but all in all, when you look at the numbers, there was still kind of a dedicated core audience. But that audience is now shrinking and shrinking, and we've gotten to a real, you know, small percentage of Americans overall that fit into that audience dynamic. And so newspapers are sort of up against this hourglass where that sand is going at a faster and faster pace of people moving to the web before they can find a sustainable model there. It was interesting to listen to Nancy talk about her nonprofit experience. We've done a fair amount of research in that space too, because indeed what happened when there were so many layoffs, in particular from newspapers, FTEs or the full-time employees are 40% of what they've fallen 40% in the last 20 years. So we had a lot of folks that were taking buyouts, leaving that more traditional newspaper. And they just had a passion for journalism. They wanted to tell their story. They wanted to be able to do that deep reporting and started nonprofits. There was a big rise in nonprofit news organizations. A lot of them got 1 or 2 years of funding through a foundation, through some kind of grant. And they had maybe 3-4 individuals that were largely journalists working to do and produce stories, many of which, as Nancy said, were very in-depth pieces looking at a specific niche topic, whether it's education or the environment or some kind of investigative work. But they also faced challenges. And we held a day-long event after some of our research to talk with folks in that space. And what we heard from many was there were 3 main challenges. One was finding an audience that was big enough, because even if you were putting out these kinds of stories, you maybe were producing 2 a week.
And you have to find people to want
right,
to see
to
those.
Consistently come back, right? To come back and find those. And the other was the knowledge around technology. You know, how do we do this in a way that's innovative digitally and that can appeal in that digital space? And then the third was money. That,
sure.
You know, you went into it with grant and suddenly that grant was coming up and you hadn't thought about how am I going to sustain this? We have started to see some partnerships with the local newspaper and these nonprofits where...
Like Nancy talked about.
Like Nancy talked about. And there's more of those that are happening throughout the country. And the local newspaper can win, too, because it's got some of that in-depth reporting that it didn't have in the past.
Do you want to jump in, Meg, real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that point about a kind of an ecosystem of information is really important. When we're talking about these digitally native startups, I don't think any of us are, you know, wishing that they somehow replace all of the legacy news organizations out there. In reality, it's going to take both. And I think it's really important, even in a state as small and rural as New Hampshire, that multiple news organizations exist, because no one entity is going to be perfect and no one entity is going to be able to tell every story that needs to be told.
Especially in a day when we see shrinking newsrooms. I mean, just the trend continues.
Exactly.
Well, and joining us now on the phone is someone else who is working in this nonprofit journalism space. Anne Galloway is with us. She's editor of the VermontDigger.org, an online news website. She's executive director of the Vermont Journalism Trust. That's the publisher of VermontDigger.org. And Anne Galloway, first of all, I just love the name, Vermont Digger. You've been around for a while, one of the early ventures into this. What led you to start Vermont Digger?
Well, like so many journalists, as Meg and Amy have described, I was laid off in January of 2009. I was an editor at the Times, Argus, and Rutland Herald. And as soon as I was laid off, I knew that I wanted to stay in the field. And in order to do that, I believed that I needed to start a website. And I always envisioned a full-blown news organization, not a blog. And I started out kind of like Nancy did with New Hampshire In-Depth. We had long-form pieces 2 to 3 times a week in the fall of 2009. And then in 2010, I decided that we'd never have enough eyeballs on the site if we didn't publish daily. And so at the time, I didn't have any reporters on staff. And like Nancy, I relied on freelancers and volunteers. And I wrote quite a bit myself, and I covered the Vermont legislature. I also published press releases and commentaries, and within about 6 months, we had 14,000 readers a month. Eventually, we joined with the Vermont Journalism Trust, and we were able to get some grant funding, and I hired our first reporter in 2012, and we now have 15 people on staff.
Wow, that's 12, pretty big.
12 of whom are journalists.
Covering a small state like Vermont. So I wonder how you, I asked the same question to Nancy West, your colleague here in New Hampshire, how do you pay the bills?
Yes, well, we have a budget of $1.1 million this year, and 40% of our funding comes from underwriting, which is the nonprofit version of advertising. 40% comes from donations from readers, large and small, 15% from grants, and about 5% of our income comes from news revenue. We resell our content to local newspapers around the state at a very low cost. And then last year, we actually embarked on a joint project with a newspaper in Brattleboro called The Commons, and we actually share the cost of a reporter there. And we're engaging in the same kind of relationship with the Bennington Banner in the next couple of months.
I wonder what you think, Anne, about the trend that Amy described to us earlier, more and more people consuming news, preferring to get news on their mobiles, on their mobile devices, a dipping in and out instead of saying, okay, now I'm going to sit down and have my coffee and, you know, read the newspaper for half an hour. I wonder what you think about that and specifically how it affects what you produce at Vermont Digger.
Well, we certainly have a range of story lengths, but I'm a little bit of a contrarian. I guess otherwise I wouldn't have started reading it in the first place. But, you know, I've published stories that are as long as 9,000 words. We also publish briefs that are 200 words. And mostly our interest is in making sure that people have all the information they need on a given topic. And what's beautiful about the web is that we can link to other news sources, to original source documents, to other kinds of websites, and it creates this kind of reader ecosystem that I think is really cool, and people respond to that. Of course, we're able to also include podcasts and video. So the thing about the web is it's just so dynamic and so much more interesting than reading a newspaper. I love print, but I also see great advantages for the reader online.
Well, Anne, it's really good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Anne Galloway, again, editor of VermontDigger.org, an online news website. You can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. How do you consume your news these days? How do you think your own consumption habits have changed? And does America's changing news consumption profile or trends, do those change the actual content of what we understand, of what we know about the world around us? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Again, email is exchange at nhpr.org. And Meg, you know, it's so interesting to hear from Anne Galloway at Vermont Digger. There she is in a small state, a small organization, and she's doing investigative. She's doing online short forms. She's doing podcasts. She's doing video. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
It really is. And I think it's a good example of how all of the changes in the news industry are also really reshaping the genre of nonfiction storytelling. And as a story geek that I am, I just find that really, really exciting and interesting. And yeah, there are these serious questions about access to quality information and how we're going to pay for it. But at the same time, we can face those questions and still be really excited about the type of journalism that is happening digitally and that's coming out of these startup newsrooms and also out of legacy newsrooms. And that's a really, really exciting trend.
What do you think, Amy? What do you pull out of what we heard from Anne Galloway?
We have seen a lot of interesting experimentation in the digital video space when it comes to news over the last year, year and a half. Also on the revenue side, you know, the revenue tied to online news videos is growing, and online video in general, even though it's a small portion of the total at this point. It's interesting because we are exposed to a lot of new ways and just, you know, interesting ways to engage the reader, to be able to tell the story, you know, in a way that is exciting and different and can be more informative than just, you know, through words alone. At the same time, we asked Americans about their preference of reading, watching, or listening to news. How do you prefer to get your news? And what we found was sort of really does reveal the state of the digital space at this point. We found, first of all, more Americans prefer to watch than prefer to read or prefer to listen. Those that prefer to read have largely migrated online, as we talked about and we talked about earlier. Those that prefer to watch are still largely doing that through the television. So a lot of this experimentation and innovation that we're seeing hasn't yet hit sort of the mass of the American public in terms of becoming the norm of the way that they watch. And it's going to be interesting and exciting, I think, to watch and see how that develops, if and when, you know, when and if to a certain extent, that transition of video really for the large majorities of the American public does, you know, take place and move to a digital screen of some form.
Yeah, I was just reading something this morning, Meg, that confirms what Amy said, that more and more people do prefer to watch, as she said, still on TV, but more and more people want video, you know, as a part of their overall news consumption experience. We can't even call it TV, radio, print. It's all kind of one big mishmash.
Right, absolutely. And the other thing that I find really fascinating in my own habits and the habits of other news consumers that I talk to is this idea of a second screen, watching a news report on CNN and following the story on Twitter, too. It's this third dimension that's really interesting.
Right. We saw some of that in some of the presidential debates mm-hmm. where Facebook
yes.
was a co-sponsor
yeah.
and there were a couple things going on at the same time. Well, coming up, we will talk with someone from a so-called legacy newspaper, the Union Leader, and how it is coping with some of these changes we've been talking about. And we'll take your questions and comments, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at a new study on how we consume news and the impact of those changes. For example, about half of Americans these days get their news from Facebook. Many more of us prefer to get news on our social media feeds, on our mobile devices. You can join us, too, with your thoughts, questions, comments about this and tell us how you consume your daily news. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Meg Heckman is here. She's at UNH. And Amy Mitchell, she's at the Pew Research Center. And with us now is David in Ware. Hi, David. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hello, Laura.
Good morning. You're on the air, David.
Great. I was thinking how we have been willing for many years to give contributions to organizations that advocate for it. I'm thinking of Greenpeace, for instance, on the liberal side of things, or the Southern Poverty Law Foundation. But we probably haven't been willing to... Are you there?
We're still there, David. Yep, we're listening.
Good. But we haven't been giving donations to the organizations that do the investigative reporting that we want. So I think we're going to have to start getting used to doing that.
Well, David, thank you for the call. And Meg, you're nodding. Go ahead. It is a kind of a mind shift for people. They're used to plunking down 25 cents or 50 cents for their newspaper, and they're done with it.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think mind shift is just the right word. And I think that journalists are sometimes great at telling other people's stories and not always great at telling the story of why our work matters. And that's something that we're going to need to get better at.
Although it's tough to find those dollars, Amy, because there are ways to get around paywalls online. There are ways to get content without paying for it, even despite the best efforts of some news organizations. Go ahead, Amy.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we're at a point now where we have a whole generation of news consumers that began never paying. You know, so those of us that are older that, you know, we're used to subscribing and we had the money that we put into our news product on a regular basis, and we felt a little guilty when we were going online and not paying anything. And so, you know, we're more willing when those subscriptions started coming online to say, yeah, okay, well, that makes sense. But when you've got a generation that's never had to pay, the question is, well, why would I? You know, why would I start doing that now?
And there's ways to get around it, too.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. If you do a search through Google, in some cases, you know, you can, you know, get the link to pop up because what, you know, we call these things soft walls. Many news organizations have set up soft walls because they don't want to completely lose an audience member. So they allow maybe 20 stories per month, or they allow, if it's through search, for you to be able to read it, because there's a little bit of risk. Most newspaper organizations now have more people reaching their content just, you know, digitally than they have any type of subscriber, whether it's, you know, the combination of digital and print subscribers together.
Well, joining us now on the phone is somebody who probably thinks about this on a daily basis. Trent Spinner is with us. He is executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Trent, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here to be able to stand up for the quote-unquote old-fashioned newspaper.
Well, we've been talking, Trent, about how hard it's been for some publications to make adequate revenues online, why traditional print advertising doesn't seem to migrate so much to digital. What's it been like for you at the Union Leader? Has digital brought in the kind of ad revenue that you need to keep the paper going?
Well, that's a great question. And what we've done since I've taken over the editorship here over the last 2 years is what we've said is, we understand that not as many people are reading the newspaper in the morning. We get it. But where are people? And I think your guests have talked about this over the last hour. People are checking in on their Facebook page at lunch. They're looking at their mobile phone while they're at the gas station or in between meetings. They're going online at night. And so what we've tried to really do is say, okay, if you're not reading the paper in the morning, where can we find you? How can we get our content to you? And we've been very successful at that. And so our strategy has been, if you're not getting the paper, we'd love to see you on our Facebook page, or we'd love for you to click one of the links on our Twitter account, or we'd love for you to download the e-edition. And that has worked for us.
So it's that dipping in and out that Amy described at the beginning of the hour.
Exactly. Our chief operating officer here calls it a media buffet. People are going to be kind of snacking throughout the day, and we want to be that buffet for you, and we're going to have different options for you throughout the day.
Instead of the morning meal, that morning newspaper, or the evening meal, that evening TV news broadcast, how does that consumption change, Trent, change the actual reporting that you do with the Union Leader? Do you have to make your stuff, you know, snack-sized?
It doesn't change the actual reporting. We have really invested in content. And so our reporters are going out and they're doing the work that people expect. But what we're doing is we're formatting that differently. So we know what a print story looks like. We know that that's that comprehensive story that's backed up by graphs and photographs. But what about the tweet? And what about the quick web update? And so what we're doing is we're doing the same kind of content. We're just packaging it in different ways throughout the day so that people know, okay, if I want to know about why 93 is closed down right now, I can go to the Twitter account or I can go to the Facebook page. But if I want the comprehensive story about the, like last week, the firefighter who died, I know I can go pick up the Sunday paper, and there will be a complete story about his life, his work, and how the department misses him.
How do you maintain a balance, Trent, between the immediacy of the web, you know, wanting to know right now, and the kind of hours, painstaking work of investigative journalism, for instance? You know, it takes a long time to really dig up these sources and information on the big stories that really matter. So I just wonder how you shake that all out.
There is no balance. That's really important, and that's really what I push my reporters to do every day, is realize that you have to be doing all of these things at the same time. And yes, that has been a struggle for a lot of them. But what we're saying is, if there's breaking news, we need an update on it right now. Before you even leave the office or leave your house to go check it out, we want you to be calling your sources and get that information up immediately. So you're already starting on your reporting as soon as you hear something. And then throughout the day, you're building on that reporting. So at the end of the day, now you have the comprehensive story that we can print the next day. But there's no more balance anymore, and we don't ask for that.
So you put it out in, you know, bite-sized form early on, a little bit more later, a little bit more later. Maybe there's a big investigative piece in the Sunday paper. Is that how it works, Trent?
That's exactly how it works. And so you're reporting. It's a workflow that gets you to that comprehensive story at the end, but there's nothing stopping you. The only thing that's stopping you from getting news out is that we want sources. We want to make sure that every single thing that we report is accurate. Even if we're tweeting it or doing a quick web update, we really that's what makes us different as the union leader, as the trusted voice in New Hampshire, is that our facts have been checked. We have sources. And that's why I think people are willing to pay for our content.
Well, given the many directions that any news organizations, whether it's TV, radio, print, whatever, given the many directions that an organization can go, how do you decide, Trent, which way to go? You know, Meg talked about this earlier. Do you invest more in, you know, making your website attractive? Do you invest more in Twitter? Do you decide to embed video into, you know, 50% of your pieces? Because resources are not unlimited.
That's right. And so what we're looking at every day, is we're looking at how many people can we impact? How many people will this content, whether it's a video or it's a web story or even editorial decisions, how many people will it impact? And if it will impact the entire state, obviously that's a story we want to invest a lot in. That's a story that we want to produce multimedia content for. It's a story we want to put on the front page. If it's a story that we don't think will impact that many people, we're not obviously going to invest in it. So that's our metric, is how many people do we think that this will impact? And what's great about the internet is that we can see pretty much live what people are reading. We can see how many people are reading stories, where they're coming from. So are a lot of people coming from a link from a national news organization? Are they coming from our Facebook page? What about the Facebook post or Twitter or tweet was successful that got people into our site? And then once they're reading the story, we can see how far they're reading the story, where they're going after they read that story. And we can also see that for our e-edition too. So we can see, based on our layout and our headlines, how well we did every single day. And that's something we talk about every single day in our news meeting. So there's a lot of data that's available now to measure how well we are impacting the state of New Hampshire.
Well, and that's an important point that I wanted to ask you about, Trent. So I'm glad you raised it. How does the ability to measure what those eyeballs are doing, as you said, how many times people view a story, how long they read it, where they get it, and so forth, how does that affect what you cover?
It's part of the decision, but it's not 100%. And I'll give you a great example from last week. Last week, Mike Pence was in Manchester. That's our hometown. He's Donald Trump's VP nominee. He was in Manchester. He came to the union leader. He sat down for an interview with the publisher, the executive editor, one of our senior political reporters, and we had big coverage. It was the lead story, big blown-out headline, and we could see that that was the number 20, the 22nd most read story that day.
22nd most
right?
read.
It was our lead story. We invested a ton of resources.
Sure, it's a big story.
Do you want to know what number one was?
Sure.
Okay, it was two rabbits who died of a heart attack in Epping. Two rabbits who died of a heart attack because of those jets that that flew into Pease last week. Their owner said that they died from the loud noise. That was the most read story. So, but is that the most important story? I would argue no. Even though our readers, more readers chose to click on that story or to read that story, it wasn't our lead story, and it should not have been our lead story. So as much as the numbers inform our decisions, they don't dictate it.
All right. I think that says it right there. Politics and bunny rabbits, and you're not going to let the bunny rabbits dominate the front page every single day.
The bunnies will not win.
Well, Trent, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Trent Spinner, again, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And wow, Amy and Meg, a couple questions to follow up on. Amy, I think what Trent is talking about there with the bunny story is what people call clickbait, right? It's a interesting, cute, often involves kittens or bunnies that gets people to click on your site, the bait, so to speak. What do you think about the use of clickbait and its role?
Well, there's certainly clickbait is an element of sort of entertaining news, but it's more than that too. There are just feel good stories, and news organizations have covered these, you know, for decades and generations.
Absolutely.
Where you just want to have that story that's just interesting or different or makes you feel good. When we ask about the different kinds of topics that people are getting news about, and particularly in the digital space, entertainment's often the first, you know, it's often first. It often more people are getting some kind of entertainment news than anything else. But at the same time, news about your local community, news about national government and politics are regularly up there in the top four or top five. And so it's often a mix. And people are drawn to things that are interesting, that interest them, that they may want to share. So entertainment's going to be in that mix. It doesn't mean that people aren't also getting other kinds of news as well. I think what Trent's talking about in terms of balance and how you make those decisions, how you use, in many conversations with journalists, there's been a shift from just, you know, the fear of the audience numbers, you know, of having to see those every hour, to saying, how do we use them in a smart way to deliver the best product that we can and the best mix of stories that we can? If there's a story that's not getting traction, why is that? Should we think about the way we formatted that or the way that we, you know, somehow packaged it or when we released it? So how do we use the combination of knowledge that we can gather today to be able to give people what, you know, we, the journalists and news organizations, you know, feels is that best mix?
Yeah, what do you think about that, Meg? The blessing and maybe the challenge of having all this data that tells you immediately, as Trent described, this is how people are reading or not reading your stuff.
Yeah, human editors still need to be making the decisions. And those decisions should definitely be informed by the needs of the community. And you're right, we do have more data than ever before to inform those decisions. And we need to think about how we're using that data. And as we are reconsidering our production routines and the decisions that we make around what is news, we should be thinking about who we're listening to. And we should really use this as an opportunity to make sure that the stories that we're telling are truly representative of our entire society. For instance, a few summers ago, when events were unfolding in Ferguson, the hashtag Ferguson really, really nudged the mainstream media into covering the riots and the events that were going on there in a way that they probably hadn't been beforehand. And so we've seen some really powerful use of social media by the audience to really shift the attention that news media is paying to certain stories that maybe don't always get the coverage they should.
Well, and to follow up on what you said, Meg, you know, Trent telling us that the number one story was bunnies, the number 22 story was, you know, VP nominee Mike Pence coming to Manchester. So the takeaway isn't, you know, start all your publications with bunnies and kittens, but maybe the fact that number 22 is politics means people don't, they're getting sick of politics, or they don't want as much politics, or they don't care as much about politics.
It could be.
How informative is that? I'm wondering.
I don't know. I mean, there are so many variables in what people click on and how things get traction online. To be perfectly honest, I think I probably also would have clicked on a story about two poor bunnies having a heart attack. So I understand the draw for that. I also think that that just means news organizations need to be smarter and more clever about how they're attracting people to that good civic information that they need to fully participate in society. And I think Trent was hinting at that some when he talked about analyzing what works and what doesn't work and constantly reshaping things as they go.
As Amy talked about, too, how you are presenting
right.
that story that may seem a little bit drier on its face. Both of you, lots more to talk about, but we will shut it down here. Amy Mitchell, it's good to have you. Thank you very much for being with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Amy Mitchell, Director of Journalism Research at the Pew Research Center and one of the authors of Pew's latest State of the News Media Report. Meg Heckman, always good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Meg Heckman, lecturer teaching journalism in the English department at UNH, where she teaches a course on entrepreneurial journalism. Remember that our conversation always continues online on Facebook and nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kinoy.